I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Jeremy Stoppelman, co-founder of Yelp, a company that provides user-generated reviews of local businesses through its website and mobile app. Jeremy launched Yelp in 2004 with Russell Simmons, whom he met while working at PayPal, and the company went public in 2012. Jeremy is from Virginia and graduated with a degree in engineering from the University of Illinois in 1999. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
I'd like to start with your earlier life before we jump into Yelp. You grew up in Virginia. Mm-hmm. Your mom was an English teacher. Your father was a securities lawyer.
That's right.
You enjoyed picking stocks. And at the time, reviewing stocks was not an electronic business. It was opening up the New York Times and going through these lists. And what were one or two stocks that you followed?
Early on, I was still always into computer technology and technology in general. And so the first couple of stocks that I personally bought were Micron Technology, which made memory chips for computers, and Applied Materials, which made machines for creating silicon wafers. But, I think my interest probably started with baseball cards, if you wanted to go even a little bit earlier to to how did I get interested in stocks, is I loved, buying and selling baseball cards and going to, conferences or get-togethers where people would trade those sorts of things.
And the gum that you would get in the packages of the baseball
cards. The stale
cards.
Gum was never the highlight. Every month, talk about paper businesses, I would get like the Beckett's report on prices for all of your baseball cards, and I'd watch them go up and down, and that just translated into stock picking once I was old enough to do that, probably around 13, 14 years old.
It seems obvious to draw a connection to your father, who was in the securities business.
Sure.
But your mother, what influence did English have on your professional life?
She had a love for reading, and she had a love for writing. She still has a love for writing. And I really enjoyed writing growing up and enjoyed essays. I entered a poetry competition, when I was probably 12, 13 years old. And that carried all the way through. And I think it's no surprise that the company that I helped found is partially about writing. It's a community of writers.
You've also have a blog where you reviewed nonfiction books,
sure.
Although your last post, I think, was in 2010.
Yeah, it's gotten a little stale.
All right. You also were a tinkerer. Can you just provide one or two examples of that?
As a child, I really loved to understand how things worked and to get physical with them and get my hands on them and build things. I got very into remote control cars, and not the kind that you just buy pre-assembled, but the kits that you have to put everything together, and there's a lot of maintenance involved and moving parts and servos and remote controls and all sorts of little technology gizmos. And so I love that. I spent probably most of my early teen years playing with remote control cars and building them.
When was your first encounter with computers?
The story of how I got my first computer was my dad apparently had a client that couldn't pay his bill, but ended up having a bunch of Packard Bell computers sitting around. And so essentially my dad got barter for his legal services, and we ended up with our first Packard Bell computer, which I wasn't supposed to touch. It was hands-off, but that didn't stop me. And I spent lots of time learning how to use it and program it and play with it, erasing the hard drive and making it non-operable for a while, to my mom's chagrin. And that really got me started in the journey that, ultimately led to my later career.
You knew from very early on that you wanted to be an entrepreneur, that you wanted to start a company. And you would read these magazines of these people who would start companies, and you would say, I want to be that guy. Now, who was that guy? Who are some of those people you aspired to be?
Yeah, I read a lot of technology magazines, like PC Magazine. I would read cover to cover because I wanted to know everything about computers. I also would read, Forbes, which was lying around the house. But then there was also the PC Titans, the Bill Gates of the world, the Michael Dells. And I would read about them and their stories and how, they went, from kind of college age to technology titan almost overnight. So those were some of the people that I worshipped.
You went to the University of Illinois. You majored in engineering. And after college, you got your first job in Silicon Valley at a company called At Home. You were bored there. How come? And this is a company that became at Excite at Home, right?
Yeah,
is that
so
right?
They were the first commercial cable internet provider. And so I got recruited there straight off campus, funny enough, by a now Google executive, Jeff Huber. You know, when I got exposed to Silicon Valley, like that was just a mind-blowing experience. My first trip to interview there was very eye-opening.
What were some impressions that you remember?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that stands out the most was driving down the 101 headed to my interview from my hotel, which was probably by the airport. And I remember seeing billboards for esoteric technologies. Like I remember one that was, you know, buy our FPGA, which is, you know, something that hardware designers use to create circuits and try them out. And I was like, this is such a strange place that there's enough engineers that people would actually be buying billboards for thousands and thousands of dollars to advertise the people driving down the highway, thinking that enough people would even understand what that thing was. It's like I barely knew what an FPGA was. And so that made me feel like I had found the right place. And it's an engineer's paradise.
In your 20s, where one can feel that they're sort of in this amorphous stew of what to do, you were fortunate to kind of land with, in a directed manner, even though at home was not the place.
Yeah. I often, you know, run into people or talk to people that, you know, haven't figured out or aren't sure what they want to do with their lives. And it was strange that I've always had a sense of direction of kind of where I should go next. I've never quite understood that feeling of being completely lost. Like I'm kind of a decisive person, and so I generally don't get anxiety when it comes to making decisions. You know, I think about it, wrap my head around it, make the decision, and then I'm ready to move on and get the job done.
What are some other early impressions of Silicon Valley?
Once I had decided to leave At Home Networks, I found my way accidentally just through a recruiter that cold called me to X.com, which was one of the precursors to PayPal. And it was a company that had been founded by Elon Musk. You know, sure, I had read about Bill Gates being, you know, 19 or so when he started his company, or Michael Dell starting out of a dorm room, but I'd never met any of these folks. So it was sort of mythological creatures. But when I met Elon, he had already sold his first company for hundreds of millions of dollars and was moving on.
Which one?
It was a Yellow Pages company, actually, that he sold to Alta Vista, I believe called Zip2. It was the first Yellow Pages, I guess, on the internet, ironically. And so he just had a nice success, and he was 28 years old. And so it was my first brush with a young entrepreneur that had already kind of made it. And that was a shocker. It was like, wow, here's a really young, brilliant person. And he's telling me the story of his new company. And he's saying this little company of, you know, 20, 30 people is going to take on Visa and MasterCard someday. And he said it with perfect confidence. And he had sort of this twinkle in his eye. And right at that moment, I was like, I just got to sign up and work with, like, I have to be in the presence of this entrepreneur. I want to see where this is going. This is definitely an interesting place to be.
And it was happenstance that brought you there. And they, you know, as you said, merged with Peter Thiel and Max Levchin and the company that became PayPal, where you were for 3.5 years and went through the merger with eBay. You know, you mentioned before that you drive things, but it seems like things were driving you, too. You just happened to get into the right places at the right times to some degree.
Looking back on that, I was supremely lucky, you know, to have met Elon at that moment. But at the same time, you know, there was decision, like there was some important decisions that had to be made. It's like I had to decide to leave At Home Network when I did, before the whole thing crashed and jobs were more scarce. And I also, you know, was fortunate to recognize this Elon was an interesting person, and I bet, you know, it was a bet that I made and ended up there. And I actually, around that same time, I had friends. One of the other jobs I had uncovered was at this company called Ink2Me, which was kind of a precursor to Google. And they were willing to pay me a lot more money to go work there. And so I remember calling up Elon and saying, look, I've got this other offer. It's like $20,000 more. Can you do something? Help me out. And he's like, nope. Like, when I come to X.com, you're going to have to take the offer that I gave you. And so I did. I took a lot less money to go to X.com, and it proved to be a very fortunate direction. Mm-hmm. And then some of my friends went over to Inktomi, and then Inktomi kind of imploded. But fortunately, those employees learned about search, and therefore they all got jobs at Google. So right. It worked out in the end for everyone.
Incidentally, what other jobs did you have growing up?
My first job was a landscaper. And so I was mulching and digging fence hole posts and, putting down fertilizer. I thought I got paid well at the time. I think it was $6.25 an hour. Yeah, and it was a beautiful garden. That was probably the best part.
I asked partly because, the PayPal and Yelp, these are services, mm-hmm. and you're not making actual things. Mm. And I was wondering if you had experience with actual things and navigating that dichotomy, because your life is out there now.
In the digital world,
right.
Yeah. The interesting thing is that building software actually feels like making things. And, that might seem weird when you hear that described, but, that's one of the things that I love so much about software and building internet services is there is this instant gratification of you write a few lines of code and you've produced something. Like, it works. That's a creation. Mm-hmm. That's a thing. But frankly, an iPhone, the software is just as important as the hardware. It's the two working together that really makes the beautiful device that it is.
You spent 3.5 years at PayPal, and you decided to go to Harvard Business School. And incidentally, you asked Elon Musk to write a recommendation for you. Mm-hmm. What was the content of that recommendation?
I have no idea what he wrote, but I did get in. So I take it that he probably didn't say terrible things. But there were a couple. I didn't get into all the schools I applied. Harvard was actually the only one.
Mm-hmm. I read somewhere where he wrote he should not go here because he just felt like, why do you need school when you have, been a senior manager at PayPal, et cetera?
There is that thread that goes through a number of these senior people formerly of PayPal, Elon, as well as Peter Thiel, I think, is particularly well known for that. Max Levchin has, prided himself historically on getting people, including myself, to drop out of academic programs.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jeremy Stoppelman, co-founder of Yelp. We'll hear more from Jeremy coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Jeremy Stoppelman, co-founder of Yelp, a company that provides user-generated reviews of local businesses through its website and mobile app. Jeremy launched Yelp in 2004 with Russell Simmons, whom he met while working at PayPal, and the company went public in 2012. You spent 3.5 years at PayPal, and you decided to go to Harvard Business School. And while you did not intend to drop out of Harvard, you did. The summer between your first and second year, you worked for Max's incubator, mm-hmm. where the germ of Yelp kind of emerged. He kind of tasked you with building the Yellow Pages for the 21st century.
Yeah, I mean, basically, I came there that summer really just to help out. And then he just kind of threw me into the fire and said, why don't you start brainstorming and see if you can come up with another idea that we could fund? And one of the threads that was floating in the incubator, sort of the things that was being talked about, was Craigslist is killing the newspaper business. Like, it's carved out the most profitable chunk, the classifieds. There's another old media business, the Yellow Pages, and it really hasn't been completely transformed by the internet. There's got to be something better that you could do that's internet native. And, in that summer, I actually, got the flu and was looking around for a doctor and was Googling, and there was, really no information other than that most bare-bones information. And there was, insurance websites saying, oh, we accept your insurance, but nothing that I felt like was useful, which is I want to go to a guy who or a woman who has, an incredible bedside manner that other people think is great, and that information wasn't available. And so that formulated the initial seed of, this is an important unsolved problem. I should be able to, I can go on Amazon right now and find the best, Wi-Fi router, but I can't go on and find a general practitioner that people like. Why is that the case?
And that's sort of like the founding myth, that I've heard about you, mm-hmm. that you were sick and you needed a doctor. Was there any other things percolating?
I mean, that doctor example is true. Yeah. It did happen. Mm-hmm. And that sort of ignited my passion for the problem. Then the question became, well, how do, you know, what is the thing that is better? You know, what is the thing that could exist on the internet that would be a better way to find local businesses? And that led us to start talking about word of mouth. Everybody has all this great information in their heads. The question then became, well, how do you get this word of mouth out of people's heads and onto the internet?
You like to call it word of mouth amplified. Mm-hmm. And you came up with an email of questions regarding local businesses, yet that was a false start because people weren't very responsive to that. But accidentally, you put on the bottom of the page, write a review, and it was kind of open-ended. Explain that a little bit.
Yeah, so I truly did not believe that people wanted to write reviews for fun about dry cleaners or all these, you know, random esoteric businesses that we all patronize from time to time. And so I thought the only way that we would capture this word of mouth is if we drew it out of people. And so literally it came down to the wire. We were about to launch our first version of the site, this Ask Your Friends for Recommendations site. And my co-founder, Russ, you know, I remember him peeking over the monitor, his monitor, he had this giant monitor. He peeks over the monitor. He's like, well, shouldn't there be a way for users to just write a review if they feel so compelled? I was trying to be open-minded. You know, again, I'm very decisive and I have my strong views and I'm kind of thick-headed. And so I'm thinking, well, nobody's going to use that. But I wanted to humor Russ, frankly. And so I'm like, yeah, just put it in where, you know, somewhere. And so he buried it. And it was literally a couple pages deep in the site. It was hard to find. And so we launched and you know, people really didn't take to the asking friends for recommendations idea. But when users would occasionally find this feature where they could just write reviews, that was, you know, that was the thing that worked. Like people would write 5 or 10 or 15 reviews just in one sitting. Mm. And so I'm looking at the data, watching how people are using the site. I'm querying the database, trying to understand, like, is there any light at the end of this tunnel? Like, we've created this thing and it doesn't seem to be working, but is there any evidence that anything is working? And that was the one thing that stood out, is like, why are people writing 5 reviews, 10 reviews?
Yet you yourself are a writer. You enjoyed writing when you were younger.
It didn't dawn on me until that moment that maybe, yes, there was something to this review writing thing.
Right. Now, initially, because you had that false start and you weren't getting traction, when you tried to raise capital, you had lackluster results from the VC community, which was a blessing in disguise because it forced you to stay local in San Francisco and focus your efforts there. Whereas if you had raised more capital, you might have, you know, tried to launch nationally. How accidental really was that?
I mean, there were a few things going on there. So Max, you know, was our first investor. He gave us $1 million in financing. And soon after, like right as we got the site basically to launch, Max was pushing us to go try and raise additional venture capital. And so we went out, we talked to a number of people, and they all wanted to see traction. And at that time, in 2004, people were not handing out money. And so we got the door kind of slammed shut pretty quickly a number of times. I probably pitched, you know, 10 or 15 different firms, and no one was really interested. There were a few other things going on. There were two competitors around the same time, both of which actually did have venture capital. So they had more money. And so this race began to kind of show who was going to be the national review site, who was going to be the biggest first. And we didn't have the money that they did. So that was definitely a factor. But then also we looked at who had been successful in local before Yelp. And the companies that stood out was Craigslist, which had really, you know, maybe not necessarily on purpose, but had pursued a market by market strategy. They became successful in San Francisco, and then they became successful in New York, and it spread kind of city by city. If you went deep in one market, we felt like that would help build a brand, it would help build credibility, and it would provide the platform for you to then leap to the next few markets, which is what we did.
What were some other kind of key pivot moments or factors that kind of helped to escalate the trajectory in the early days?
In the very early days, discovering the power of Google for distribution, that was probably one of the first big key insights beyond just the, hey, people actually do want to write reviews. That was number one. The other thing we realized is, hey, people are now writing and creating this content. You need to open it up to search engines. That was a relatively new idea. 2004 was still the early days of search engine optimization, this idea that if you put content out there, people will actually find it.
as somebody who wants to find a restaurant near me, I type in the restaurant and you come up. I have noticed that your search engine optimization is pretty badass. Go ahead.
Yeah, we do generally get ranked well, ultimately.
And your engineers helping to make sure that that happens.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of basics coming up in Google. And a big part of that is, frankly, just having content that consumers, that users who are searching Google actually want. And that's one of the, I think, true miracles of Yelp, is that people that got into the site, people that started writing reviews, basically became part of a community. You're then involved in an activity where, you know, all of these people that you're meeting also are review writers. And so what does that lead to? Well, maybe you started with a couple of restaurants, and then suddenly you feel like, you know what, I have to review everything in my life, which led to all sorts of local businesses being reviewed that had never been reviewed before. So who is going to review that dry cleaner in that little neighborhood?
Right.
Nobody until, you know, this community formed.
You've mentioned that a little over 20% of your reviews are filtered out because you have this algorithm called a review filter, which kind of is able to smell a fraudulent review.
We have what we call the recommendation engine, and it recommends about 75% of content, and it doesn't recommend about 25% of content. And, you know, what we're going for there is obviously, yeah, there's the obviously fake and shill reviews. There's the malicious reviews of a business owner trying to, you know, get their competitors and so forth. So we want to provide strong protections to make sure that that is really very difficult, if not impossible, to do. You as a business owner shouldn't have to worry about how do I boost my reputation on Yelp. You simply focus on your consumers.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jeremy Stoppelman, co-founder of Yelp, an online business directory that provides customer reviews of local businesses internationally. I want to go back to the earlier days. You know, you mentioned Google earlier, and they've been a frenemy to you. They offered to buy you in 2010 for $500 million.
It's in the ballpark,
and
as reported.
Right. And Yahoo offered to buy you as well. You ultimately said no.
Yeah, I mean, the way I thought about those opportunities at that time period was, well, maybe this helps us become international and become a worldwide brand faster. But very quickly, that initial conversation turned into a process, which turned into a little bit of a bidding war. And then I felt like the outcome wasn't necessarily going to be the best for Yelp in the long term, that it was we were going to get the most money possible at that moment. But fundamentally, that's not what I was most focused on. And ultimately, we were able to line up independent financing, and the company was strong, and so it just felt like, let's just step on the gas and go for it.
During this time, Steve Jobs enters the picture. Can you describe your first encounter with Steve?
As soon as the iPhone was born and we had an app, he loved it, and he was very vocal about how you didn't need to search anymore, you could just turn to Yelp, as somewhat loosely veiled dig at Google. And how Yelp was superior to Google, for local search. So that's where the love affair, I guess, began.
Given his aversion or his tempestuous relationship with the Google guys.
Yes. I think it's safe to say that Steve Jobs was not happy at that point with Google. They had started to compete directly with Android. And so around this time, news broke that, you know, we were potentially in M&A talks with Google. I was in a meeting. Actually talking about independent financing already. So we were already going in the direction of just financing the company and not getting bought, but he didn't know that. And so I got, you know, passed a message from my assistant saying, you know, Steve Jobs is on the line. And so I immediately was nervous, almost, I think I was shaking a little bit. I'm like, what? And so I ran out of the meeting and get the phone call transferred to my cell phone. And of course, Steve Jobs was not on the line. Steve Jobs' assistant was on the line waiting. And then she said, one moment, please. And then 5 minutes later, Steve Jobs appeared on the phone. And we did have a very nice conversation where, you know, he proceeded to tell me that he was a Yelp fan. And he thought, you know, we were building a great company and we had a great product. And he didn't want to see that go to another company, in particular Google. For me, I also got the, you know, chance to be a total fanboy and tell him how much I loved Apple products at the time.
Because he was a titan to you, going back to the early days of Jeremy Stoppelman, you know, learning about Gates, and your heart was a flutter.
Yeah.
You know, here you are, you have one success after another, and here you're on the phone with Steve Jobs calling you in the middle of a meeting. And we tend to normalize happiness. Mm-hmm. Like, once you achieve a certain state, you're like, okay, I'm kind of numb to this. What next?
Right.
And you've gotten to become those people that you looked up to when you were 10, 11, 12, 13. Do you feel like normalization has happened even in your private moments? You're thinking, okay, where to? Because it's happened at an accelerated pace.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's human nature. You know, that's what keeps us striving, is that, you know, you have these weird phone calls or meetings, or, you know, you have an IPO and you just think all of these things that you thought would never happen, mm-hmm. happen. But, you know, your brain plays tricks on you and you're like, okay, now what do I do? But I really have a tough time stopping and reflecting. Like, I don't do that. People often ask me, do you stop and smell the roses or whatever? And I'm like, no.
I wanted to talk a little bit more about Google for a moment. You know, they have tried aggressively to get into the local market, following your heels with Google Local, Google Maps, the GAT, et cetera. Are they subjects of the Lucifer effect?
The Lucifer effect. I'm trying to remember what I wrote on that.
Well, this was your last blog in 2010. Basically, it's a book about...
That's about the Stanford Prison Experiment.
That's right. And it's basically about, you could tell me better, how good people become evil. Things stay up there, Jeremy.
It's a very interesting question. I've never been asked that. It's all coming back to me now. When I read that book, what became clear to me as a manager, as a leader, the systems that you put in place have downstream effects. If you don't put in the right controls, if you're not sort of trusting but verifying, and then bad things happen, it is your fault. That is why we need to hold leaders accountable. If you talk to people that work at Google, they all believe a sort of whitewashed version of themselves where they're always the heroes and everybody else, you know, to the extent they're against what Google's interested in, is wrong.
Yet they try to stifle your own search engine optimization.
I mean, you look at some of their statements back in, say, 2004, 2005 about what did they believe they were doing. They thought they were a turnstile. They thought they were sending users to the best content on the web. They thought that, you know, sites like Yahoo or AOL that tried to hold users in and force them to go to house properties that weren't as good as the rest of the web, they thought that was wrong. And then now they've come to believe that that is so right because, well, of course, there's advertising dollars. And so that, you know, that is a function of it starts at the top with how management has changed their thinking.
I want to talk about the IPO in 2012 because it was an arrival moment. Can you just describe that with your mom next to you? What's your mom's name, by the way?
Lynn.
Lynn.
Mrs. Stoppelman, she'd probably prefer. She's old-fashioned like that.
Because this was the intersection of, oh, you've been picking stocks, and here you are.
Yeah. I mean, she was very happy that day. Like, that was, it was great to see her that happy. And I was definitely blown away. It was just, for me, it was sensory overload. Mm-hmm. I had just come off of 2 weeks of the roadshow where you're out kind of pitching Yelp, and it was grueling. You know, your city, every night you're sleeping in a different bed in a different city. And you're having, you know, a dozen meetings or several meetings at least a day, sort of saying the same things over and over. And then it culminates in this one day of the IPO. To be up there on the platform ringing the bell, I've got my brother on one side, my mom on the other, surrounded by some of our early employees and executives. And it was a total rush.
Did you think about your father in that moment who died in 1998?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely on my mind because, you know, he was a securities lawyer. And, yeah.
Are there just impressions from this whole journey that you have that you just haven't been asked, that you just think about as you're going to sleep at night? Or
I don't know. I mean, I think there's like the psychological journey of starting a company, like how almost manic depressive, you know, you know, you're up one minute and you think you're going to change the world and this is going to have a big impact. And then you're totally down next minute and you think you've got this you know, little team of 10 people and you're running them off a cliff and wasting their time and wasting your friends' money.
Yet you seem like someone who is kind of unflappable. You seem to have an even keel.
Yeah, it's interesting. Sometimes people say that, but I think the people that know me like probably say I'm moody. The only reason why I know that, I wasn't particularly aware of that until we had a little office sort of joke awards back in, I think, 2007. You know, I thought I was going to win the award for Messiest Desk. And the award that I won was Most Moody. And I was surprised. I'm like, okay, let me think about that. I guess I could see it. I think part of that is I wear my emotions on my sleeve. Like I don't have necessarily a poker face. And so people could see my emotions go up and down. And like maybe now that the company's more mature, you know, things are more stable. And so therefore I come off as more stable. But when it was earlier, I was probably more up and down.
Do you exercise to help mitigate that moodiness?
Running is very therapeutic. Yeah. And then also, like, I'll either run with my dog or I'll just take him on a long dog walk and clear my head.
What kind of dog do you have?
He's a Vizsla. And actually, that ties into the psychological story a little bit. Mm-hmm. So at the very beginning, you know, I was very stressed and my mom was worried. She actually sent me a electronic piano because I had played mm-hmm. piano as a kid. So she thought I would meditate essentially by playing piano, but that didn't stick. Mm-hmm. But I had always wanted to get a dog. And so I thought, you know what, if I'm going to do this to myself, I'm going to get a dog. We have this little crappy office and Max has a little puppy that pees all over the place. And so I can have a puppy too that can pee all over the place. Mm-hmm. And so I got Darwin and, you know, he was my savior. He was brilliant. Mm-hmm. And we've really grown up together and, mm-hmm. and he's my buddy.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. It's great to be here.
My guest has been Jeremy Stoppelman, co-founder of Yelp. Coming up, we'll meet John Oringer, founder of Shutterstock. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is John Oringer, founder of Shutterstock, an online marketplace for images, video clips, and music. The content is crowdsourced, with photographers, artists, and other contributors uploading their content in exchange for a percent of revenue when their work is purchased. John started Shutterstock in 2003, and the company went public in 2012. John lives in New York City, where Shutterstock is headquartered. Welcome.
Thanks.
You grew up in Scarsdale, New York. What do your parents do?
My dad was a science teacher, New Rochelle. My mom taught special ed in Yonkers.
And how would they describe you?
I think I was a curious kid. I was constantly taking things apart, putting them back together, trying to build stuff. I was always interested in how things worked. And once I started learning how to code, started to realize I can tell a computer what to do, I found that to be fascinating.
You had a few odd jobs, you know, as you were growing up. You did fix people's computers.
Yep.
You taught guitar. And the interesting thing actually about your guitar is that you wanted to teach guitar, so you learned how to play guitar first so that you could teach it.
Yeah, well, it actually turned out, and I think a lot of teachers would say this, that the best way to learn something is actually to try to teach it. So I started putting up flyers around Scarsdale with little pull-off tabs with my phone number on it, and I quickly learned how to kind of put together a couple of lessons.
You went to Stony Brook for college, and then you pursued a master's at Columbia in computer science. What were some of the jobs that you held after graduating?
Actually, I never really got a job. I had this skill I could program. So even in high school, what I was doing was I was creating little kind of Windows applications. At the time, Windows was the most popular operating system. And if I could create something that people would spend some money on, that was kind of exciting. So I started to look for problems people had. One of those problems were pop-ups, these kind of annoying advertisements that would interfere with your web browsing. The first one was kind of a security and privacy tool. When cookies were starting to become an issue, people were afraid they were being tracked. In the beginning of all these businesses, I would do every part of them. I was a customer service rep. I was the programmer. I was the designer. I did QA.
You also, after college, you tried to start a dating site.
Yeah, there were a whole bunch of different sites that I kind of iterated through, and turns out there was a lot of competition in the dating website world. The website that I created with a few friends didn't take off, so we kind of ditched it pretty quickly.
What was it called?
It was called Particular Personals.
What were some other companies that you kind of tried and failed at or were working on before you launched Shutterstock?
One was a legal services firm that would monitor people's trademarks. That worked for a little while, made some revenue, didn't really go far. But what it would do is it would monitor a trademark that you registered. As other people were registering things that maybe sounded like it or could infringe on it, since as a trademark owner, it's your responsibility to defend those and to find them yourself, this tool would find it for you. Turned out there was a lot of competition in that space too.
What was your parents' view of what you were doing, even before, you know, starting Shutterstock, coding and trying to start internet companies? More than 10, I think you tried.
Yeah, I think they knew that I could be self-sufficient and I would be fine because there was cash coming into my account usually doing something. But they probably didn't quite know what to think. But there were a couple of dynamics going on. I did not want to get a job. In fact, I was pretty sure I wasn't employable. Mm-hmm. I didn't think I was going to be able to last anywhere even if I got a job.
Did you ever have a conventional job?
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I probably for a couple of days delivered pizza in high school. So I kind of knew deep down I had to figure something else out. I always knew I could fall back on an hourly gig of fixing people's computers. And I also knew that if I needed to get a job as a software developer, I could find that. So that kind of took some risk out of the equation. It allowed me to pursue and fail. And so I just kept iterating through everything I could find. I used every website I could find. I used every product I can find.
Mm-hmm.
I became kind of like an online expert in everything that was being developed out there. What I realized is that when I was marketing all of these products, it was hard to find images.
That was the germ, in a way, for Shutterstock because, as you're saying, you needed images to go along with the content to make it more appealing to potential customers. And you started to create images yourself. You bought a camera and went out and just shot hundreds of thousands of photographs. At what point were you thinking, you know what, this is going to be yet another business that I'm going to try?
Well, at that point, the pop-up blocker sort of went right out of business because Microsoft built it for free into Internet Explorer, which turned out to be a very successful failure for me because it let me kind of sit back and think about what else I could create. I knew I was interested in photography, but I also knew that as an internet marketer, there was no real resource out there to easily get images. There was this rights managed model where lots of photos were sold under at the time, where you had to tell this calculator where you were going to use the image, how you're using the image, how long you're using the image for, what territory. The internet has no territory. When you put an image out on the internet, the whole world is going to see it. And you can't just pay for the United States, for instance, like you could in the print world. You know, I looked at lots of these stock photo companies and tried to figure out, could I create this content? Mm-hmm. If I spent a whole year just creating content, would I be able to compete with these sites? I bought a digital SLR. I bought a Canon Digital Rebel in 2003. It was one of the first digital SLRs to drop below $1,000. And I would just shoot everything around me. And I iteratively became a stock photographer really quick. I started to put these shots on a website called Shutterstock and charge a one-time fee for them per month. Download whatever you need. And the images actually started to fly off the shelves. I was watching the data that came in on the companies that were buying, and it was companies of all sizes. I realized I wasn't the only one having this mm-hmm. problem. The images I created were not that great. I mean, I was not a good photographer.
What were some of them?
They were the coffee mug that I was drinking out of in the morning. They were people walking down the street. If I found a cool spot to take pictures of New York City, I would go to a roof deck and do that. It was everything I could find around me, including my friends, who I eventually talked into signing model releases.
You mentioned that you were surprised by the response. Was there one or two particular visitors or customers who bought and you thought, oh, wow, Dunkin' Donuts even wants to use this? It lent some credibility to it?
I don't remember too many specifics, but I do remember that I recognized the companies coming in. They were agencies that when I Googled them and I looked up the business, they represented companies that I understood what was going on at that point. The people that were buying my images had no other option.
We mentioned your guitar playing before, and, you know, I thought about, you know, how you learned how to play guitar in order to teach it, just as you learned how to take photos in order to sell them.
I think that's an important part of kind of these businesses that I started, is that I was always the first customer. I was always trying to figure out how to get the images that now I was going to try to supply the world with.
You see that demand is higher than you might have thought. What came next?
The demand started to outstrip the supply. I was able to create tens of thousands of images. I realized quickly I needed millions. So if I was able to not be the only contributor and create an open-sourced kind of crowdsourced model where anyone could sell, could I do the math here and figure it out? And I settled on 25 images a day. It seemed like at that rate, a single user was able to get everything they needed throughout a month. And then I could back into a calculation where I could pay out 30% of everything that was coming in to contributors. And at that point, I was able to kind of open up the marketplace to both sides.
We take for granted the words like crowdsource. Oh, I crowdsourced it. But, you know, that's not a term that was ubiquitous or well known in the vernacular in early 2000s. How did you source from the crowd?
I started with online forums. I found these forums of people that were photographers helping each other out to create a better shot. So the kind of idea I had at that point was I contacted a few of them and I said, you guys are creating images just like I am. I'm making this much money off them. Would you like to too? And if you'd like to refer your friends, I'll pay you for the referrals too. So I started to kind of create some influencers. At the time, they were excited about being able to monetize something that they were never able to monetize before.
You have 70,000 contributors. Who were the first one or two? What was their profile?
They were all people that loved photography but had something else as their main job. So they were hobbyist photographers that wanted to get better at doing what they were doing. They wanted to buy that next lens that has always been expensive. This was the thing that they would do the second they left work. That was the profile.
Now, what is the range of income that, you know, a contributor might experience?
Contributors make anywhere from a few dollars a month to hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. There are definitely small businesses that have been created. There are definitely sole proprietors that are making more than they did at their jobs now.
Mm-hmm. What was like a pivot moment for you? I mean, you saw from the inception that there was real demand and you got contributors to buy in. Was there a pivot moment for you where, you know, things started to escalate even more so?
The moment that this started to, that I started to realize that this could work was when I was able to get supply in that met demand. Mm. And that's important because the entire marketplace is kind of organically driven, right? And I didn't realize this at first, but what was happening was contributors would come in, they would upload some images, and they would watch what was happening. In real time, they would get paid. They would watch what was getting sold, and then they would create more images like that. And when I started to see that happen, I started to realize that the entire marketplace, what was going to be critical was that I need to keep that connection going because otherwise the contributors are never going to know what the buyers want and vice versa. So there were other agencies that started at the time where this wasn't the case. And it's important that's there because that's what creates the network effect.
And what was going on with John Oringer, like your personal life at the time while all this is happening?
I was starting to get used to the fact that I wasn't a one-man show anymore and I had to learn how to manage people. Mm-hmm. And that turned out to be pretty difficult. I suddenly went from never working in an office to having a whole group of people that were my employees.
And having to get out of your pajamas if you needed to,
yeah.
Right? I mean, you're at home.
I was working from home. So now I was starting to have an office I would go to every day.
from the get-go, you did not raise venture capital, partly because you didn't need it, or was that wholly because you didn't need it?
It was because I didn't need it. It was also because I didn't know how to get it. It was also because New York was not a place where people, where venture capitalists understood tech companies. So I was able to kind of stay under the radar for many years and kind of and build this company that was constantly profitable because I had made it really efficient.
And at what point did people start to recognize you as well? I mean, they're generating a lot of revenue. You have an IPO in 2012, and 6 months after, you're over $1 billion in market cap. When did the industry start recognizing you, even before the IPO?
Well, photographers also always knew about us, and designers did too, but it's a pretty concentrated world of people. We're a business-to-business product, so we don't show up on consumer screens. By 2008, just about every graphic designer around knew about us. A lot of businesses knew about us. Around 2010 is when people started to notice. And then around 2012 was when we went public, and then there was no going back.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is John Oringer, founder of Shutterstock, a crowdsourced marketplace for photos, illustrations, graphics, video clips, and music. The company has over 50 million images that small businesses, corporations, and other users can purchase at affordable prices. John launched Shutterstock in 2003, and the company went public in fall 2012. John has been called Silicon Alley's first billionaire, meaning that Shutterstock was the first tech company launched in New York City to earn a market cap of above $1 billion. And John's owning more than 50% of the company, thus made you the first new Silicon Alley billionaire. But it's ironic that you took no venture capital, because Silicon Alley is, we think of as, you know, these venture-backed companies.
Yeah, yeah, it is. We did do a private equity round with Insight.
Later.
But in the beginning, I kind of didn't want someone telling me how to run the business. It was always important to me to have complete control over what was going on and be as independent as possible.
You're now in more than 150 countries and in over 20 languages. What cultural dynamics do you recognize? Are there any kind of patterns that you see, let's say, in the Netherlands versus New York versus Japan?
Yeah, we're all over the world. Yeah. And we answer the phones in New York in 20 different languages. And we translated the site into Japanese as the first language. And what happened was we were able to sell images in a country that we didn't have any customer support for, completely self-serve product, just by translating the website. And so once we realized that, we translated the site into 20 different languages from there. The search part of the website is important. And we have a whole team of people trying to make sure that your search is local, your search is relevant to where you're searching from. If someone in Japan searches for food, you want sushi to come up. If someone in the U.S. searches for food, you want hamburger to show up or something relevant.
Do you recognize the site's own images out there in the world?
Yeah. Anywhere from a blog to an online news publication to a billboard would be using our images. Hollywood films use our video.
So what's an example of some films or TV shows? I mean, House of Cards is one. What are some other examples?
With stock video, what you can do is you can use something that may have been hard to create as a transition, for instance. So documentaries tend to use a city time lapse from sunrise to sunset really quickly. So we have every city on Shutterstock. And so documentaries use a lot of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. It's getting more and more popular for websites to use video. Mm-hmm. It's getting more popular for advertising to use video. And it's getting more popular for Hollywood to start using stock video, because we're getting such amazing creative stuff, and it's very well priced.
You're a helicopter pilot. Why are you interested in helicopters?
I've always been interested in helicopters and flying and how they work. And in 2010, I decided to take a helicopter lesson. I always wanted to do it. And I took that lesson and I realized this is something I want to learn. I want to get a license to be able to fly this thing on my own. Mm-hmm. It took a while. It took like a year and a half. I went through kind of the entire training that any helicopter pilot would go through. Took me a little longer because I also have the day job to deal with, but it was awesome, and I love it. I still do it up till today.
You're also taking drumming lessons.
I'm always looking for kind of fun things to learn that are outside the scope of what I do every day. Both flying a helicopter and playing drums, they're both super tedious to learn. So you have to put all of your concentration into it. I find that when I'm able to get into something like that, that kind of distraction helps me with the other parts of my job and my life.
Well, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
My guest has been John Orringer. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.